Welcome to a special edition of the Thoughtful Gamer Podcast, where we are going down my top 50 games. It's very exciting. If you listen to our podcast regularly, you'll know that we've already done the first two installments. Today, we're going to be counting down numbers 30 through 21. So we're getting to better and better games. Here with me today, we have Orion.
Hey, what's up?
We have Matt.
Howdy.
And we have special guest Ben.
Hello.
And my lovely wife, Amber.
Hi, everyone.
Am I not special?
No, you've been on nearly every podcast.
And that makes me not special.
You're like on the front part of the credits. You don't get the special guest logo.
You're a headliner. You don't get the special guest also.
Basically, Matt, you're not special. That's what he's saying.
Yeah, that's what I was
getting. Not as special as Amber.
Okay. Clearly.
All right, so we had some heated debate already. I think I was looking through the list. This list is mostly Euro games and GMT games. Actually, it's entirely Euro games and GMT games, which I found interesting because the rest of them have kind of a mix. But I guess this is where I place my Euro games. So let's start off right off the bat with a bang. It's not the game Bang. That
Thank
is not
goodness.
On the list. My 30th favorite game of all time is Scythe.
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 Oh, this should be higher.
We've discussed this before on the podcast, but I don't like Scythe quite as much as the rest of you all, but I still think it's an amazing game. It's really good. We just got the, was it 6 and 7 player expansion?
Yep, Invaders from Afar.
Which looks really cool. And also has a surprisingly perfectly sized box. So well done, Stonemaier Games, for not putting small games in large boxes. That sounded dirty.
Now it does.
No, it doesn't. Moving on.
Anyway, Scythe is kind of a mishmash of all kinds of genres, but at its heart, it's an economic Euro game where you're trying to optimize your moves in this weird alternate history. What do I call it? Steampunk Bolshevik setting?
Yeah.
With giant mechs, and you're trying to gather resources to build things, to build buildings and mechs, and take over the map, and accomplish a bunch of different goals. It's surprisingly quick for how big it is, I think. It looks right. Like a much more epic game than it is, because the production quality on this game is through the roof. It's so good, and it looks incredible when you're playing it. But we finished one, I think, 3-player game in under an hour. Like, it could be really speedy.
Yeah, I think once, if you're playing with people who know the game, even a 5-player game isn't going to take you more than an hour and a half.
Yeah. And what I like about it mostly is that it's a really cool puzzle. It's a puzzle that of trying to figure out what you're going to do in the long term, because you have to plan your actions out. Because it has this mechanism where you can't take the same action twice in a row, so you have to keep planning out in the future how you're going to be doing all your actions to be the most efficient. The downside that really rubs me the wrong way is how the game ends, because it generally ends incredibly suddenly. You're trying to accomplish these goals, and once someone accomplishes their 6th goal, the game just ends immediately, and that can happen way quicker than you think it will. So it looks epic, but it doesn't quite feel epic. And that's probably the only reason it's this far down, when by all the other aspects, it's a really fantastic game.
I think it might be interesting at some point to explore how these engine building games end, and why we feel that some of them end too soon or sooner than we expect, or something like that. It's interesting. To me, Scythe doesn't end too soon, compared to a lot of the other games that we play that I feel it and they end too soon, you know, and you're more comfortable with the ending.
I mean, maybe that's because you're weirdly good at Scythe. Like, you haven't lost yet, right?
I lost once.
I think it ends weird. Very suddenly.
Yeah.
More so than any other game I can almost think of.
And that's maybe what I think might be interesting for further discussion. Is why is it that the ending makes sense to me, where in so many of the other engine building games, I want it to go longer.
Well, the idea, the design idea behind that is you want to end the game while it's still fun. I think in Scythe, the game ends right when it's getting its at its most fun.
Yeah. And so some of the things that happen at that point is, or some of the consequences of that is, one, combat isn't as big a deal as you might think in a game with awesome looking mechs.
Right.
But at least when we've played, we found that there isn't as much combat as we would have thought. Maybe if we were better at the game, we would have more combat.
Yeah, I think we've not done particularly well at kind of blocking the leader or trying to slow him down, which is usually you. I'm not bitter. I might be a little bit
Would you say I'm special when it comes to Scythe?
Yes.
No.
Have you played Scythe yet, Amber?
I have not. I do look forward to learning it someday.
We should play Scythe immediately after recording this with the expansion.
We'll see.
I think with Scythe, it can be hard to tell who's winning and by how much. You can kind of get a sense of how many things people have put out, but it can be hard to tell how close someone is to actually winning, which is maybe why it feels abrupt, because you'll suddenly notice, like, oh, they're going to end the game in one action or two actions. And I think that's where you can get caught by surprise, which will probably be somewhat mitigated by more plays.
Yeah, absolutely. Once you get a better feel for the game, that kind of ending too soon thing is certainly mitigated for any game. But overall, Scythe is a fantastic game. Again, it looks incredible. It might be one of the most awesome looking and perfectly like designed, graphically designed games we have, and certainly recommended. Moving on, number 29, a game only Amber and I have played because we played it back when we were visiting California a little while ago, and it's a classic. It's over 20 years old, I think, and I can totally see why it has lasted this long. That game is El Grande.
It's a fantastic game. I have to say, I enjoyed myself thoroughly, even though I played with more experienced players and was behind the entire time. I think that the fact that you feel like you're doing something the entire game makes it a great game for beginners, no matter how expert the other players they're playing with are.
Yeah, it's a pure area control or area majority game where you have cubes. Basically, you're placing cubes throughout Spain. And you get points when the areas are scored based on if you have the first, second, third most cubes there. But it introduces some weird twists. It has these bidding cards, which determine player order, which is significant, but also determines a resource of sorts of how many cubes you're going to get and who gets to take these special action cards. So that's a really interesting thing because everyone has, I think it's cards labeled 1 through 13, and you have that, once you use one of those cards, it's gone forever. And you just need to bid really cleverly to kind of get the actions you want or block people from particular actions. It's just a really nice, medium weight, but fascinating puzzle throughout. And that's what I loved about it. If I got to play this more often, and I'm sure I'll buy it at some point, it's probably going to get higher on my list. It's just really pure, and it feels like a classic.
Yeah, I agree. I also add that there's always good options for any player, and so even if a player is hopelessly behind in points, you always have something you can do that makes you feel good about playing this game. And so I think that makes it a great game to combine more experienced and more beginner players. So it makes it a good introductory game. It makes it a good play for experienced gamers as well. It's just all around fantastic.
It's a game that you could pretty much play with anyone who's interested in board games. Like, I don't know if my mom would like it. Sure. She doesn't like board games that much. But at the very least, like you're saying, if you feel like you're behind, you can just throw cubes in this tower. It has this unnecessarily large cardboard tower on the board. And one of the places you can put cubes is this tower. And then at the end of each round, you reveal the cubes and then put them on the map. So it's this like buzzer beater mechanism where you can sneak in cubes into areas to take them over at the last second.
Like tower like Amerigo?
It's almost that big. But it's literally just functions as an empty space to hide cubes in. But it's like 5 inches tall.
Is the tower the big?
You mean the Grande, you mean?
Yes.
I have no idea. Anyway, El Grande is a fantastic game, and it's moved up quite a bit on my list of games I want to purchase. Next on my list, a slightly lighter game, one of my favorite pure co-op games, Forbidden Desert, from local company Game Right.
All right.
Very nice. Good.
A lot of people, like, when they think of Matt Lee Cuck's games, they go immediately to Pandemic. And while Pandemic has a really cool look and a cool theme, I think from a gameplay perspective, Forbidden Desert is his best game. It's a pure co-op game where the idea is that everyone has crash-landed on this desert landscape, and you need to go around and dig through the different tiles on the board to try to find these airship parts for your weird steampunk airship thing, and then meet together on the launch pad to escape the desert. The problem is that the sun can be very hot, which depletes your water, and the sand moves around the board. So it has this sandstorm thing going on where there's like an eye of the storm, and it moves around and just leaves sand in its trail. And that can like it's bury like people.
The actively moving dunes in this like sand hurricane.
Yeah, and it's such a brilliant mechanism. I love it so much.
It is.
And it looks so cool. It's so evocative of a giant sandstorm, and it creates this really neat, random, but kind of tightly controlled puzzle that you have to try to work together and solve. And it's very simple to learn. We've taught it to people who aren't board gamers, but I think from a, like a pure co-op perspective, it's just a brilliant puzzle.
I think this is a really great game. A lot of people, I believe it's the sequel to Forbidden Island, is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think it's head and shoulders above Forbidden Island, mostly because of that that sand mechanism that you were talking about. I think that's just a really cool way to present hazards to the gamers, and it's really tough to predict, but you can kind of predict for it a little bit. It's a great game, and one of my favorite things about this is that there's an actual model of your airship. Yes. That you can put together with all the pieces, and it's so cool.
It's completely unnecessary, too. They didn't need to put in a little plastic airship that you can assemble and then go and fly away with it at the end of the game when you've won. But they did, and they still kept the game really cheap. I think it's like $20. So hats off to Game Right. It's the most awesome unnecessary game component I think ever.
It also comes in a cool tin box.
Yes, tin boxes are actually very controversial. I like them. I think they're really cool, but some people despise them. I think it's fun.
They don't mix well with your other board game boxes, but it is cool. So you described the game as tight, and I think that is maybe what sets this one apart for me among some of the other co-op games, is it's so simple. It's played on this 5x5 grid, but the things that you have to do are so easy to understand. And so, and yet there's enough depth there that every game that I've played feels exciting. You're racing against a sandstorm. The other thing that the game does really well is I think it makes everyone who's playing feel good. Like each person has a different character with a different special ability. And, you know, inevitably once a game, your character's time is going to come up and has to do something really cool. And, you know, you're the only one that could have climbed over that sand dune because you're the climber. And then you get to physically pick up this unnecessarily included part, you know, and then you physically get to keep it until you get back to the ship and put it on. And you just feel good about that.
It, of the games on my list, it might be the best, like, family game, like parents and children playing together. This might be the best one for that.
I'd agree.
Yeah, that's fair.
Because it's easy enough that, you know, even relatively younger kids could learn it and understand it. Plus, it's fully co-op, so even if they don't fully understand, they can be included, you know, and have help from the other players. It looks cool. You get these cool plastic, again, this awesome airship, and it's just a really fun experience. I think it's even more difficult than Pandemic, though.
So much more difficult. I've lost so many games of Forbidden Desert and so few of Pandemic. that I think there's almost no comparison between the two.
Like, on normal difficulty, I feel pretty confident that I can beat Pandemic nearly every time. We are, what, maybe 60% to 70% on normal, and we've never won on the next level up on Forbidden Desert.
Hey, speak for yourself. I thought we won once.
You have?
Once, yes.
I've won on the higher ones before, I know.
I like the test of, is a game fun when you lose? And this game is very fun when you lose. You're always so close, and the feeling of together just falling short is almost as exciting as pulling off the victory.
Yeah. It's a great co-op.
One caution I'd say is that this falls prey to what a lot of co-op games do, is if you have one dominant person who's played the game before, they can kind of just control the whole game and tell people what to do, and that can ruin the game experience for some people. So if you have someone like that, don't play with them or find some way to, you know.
All right, let's move down to number 27, a game constructed entirely out of math. That game is Power Grid.
But still fun enough to use your gut on decisions. Don't worry, if you don't enjoy math, you can still have fun with this game.
Amber does not enjoy math.
But I love Power Grid.
I'm surprised it's this low on your list, honestly.
Really? It's a bit dry for me. It's not as thematically evocative. And at some point, you do have to like sit there and be like, okay, I can guesstimate this, or I can pull out the calculator and figure out the actual best move, but that would be obnoxious. But it's a really interesting game. It's about constructing a power grid across Germany or US or whatever map you're playing. And it has the best functioning market that I've ever seen in a game. It's just super simple that as you buy more power resources like coal or oil, the price of those resources increases. So part of your decision making is trying to figure out what kind of power stations you want to have. Do you want to have coal? Do you want to have oil, nuclear, trash based? What's that called? Thermal depolymerization?
Wait, what?
I think, trash power plants are called thermal depolymerizers.
I think that's word you're the looking process. For is garbage.
Yeah, we just call them garbage.
I was throwing out a fun fact. That is the technical name for things that turn garbage into power.
I think they have a little like laser thing that just extracts the power from the garbage, Mark.
Come on, guys. It's just more fun to burn trash.
Anyway, it has that basic market mechanism, and it has bidding, an auction mechanism for actually acquiring the power plants, which is really fun. Auctions are fun. But the most interesting part of the game is the way it handles turn order, in that turn order is everything in this game, and it's really weird. Whoever can power the most cities at the beginning of a round goes first and follows that order. And the detriments to being ahead in the turn order are so severe that a lot of playing the game well is trying to not be ahead until the very end of the game because it's so costly. So it's this weird kind of dance around trying to not be ahead. And I like it. It's just a very bizarre thing for a game to do. I talk about this a bit more in my article on catch-up mechanisms, because this is, I think, the most significant catch-up mechanism in any game I've ever played. Despite that, and some kind of because of it, I think it's a fantastic Euro game.
Yeah, I agree. I was going to say, along those lines, for a Euro game, this does a really strong, it takes a really strong position on the runaway leader problem and not letting someone just dominate the entire board, which you can run into in some of the games in this category. And this really, it hurts you so much to go first that you almost can't do that and win. It's very difficult.
Yeah, it's extremely difficult. And at the very least, it forces the game to be very close until the end.
Yeah.
It's hard to really fall behind that badly.
The last turn ends up with a lot of counting. How much can I spend for this? And how many resources do I have? And how many cities can I power? And do I win or not? But up until that point, it's a lot of fun, for sure.
Yeah, I'd say it has a very strong early and mid game. Extremely strong mid game, I think, when you're trying to position your power plants effectively and trying to get the power plants that you need to complete the number of houses you need to power. That part's really strong, and it kind of dips down at the end, which can be sort of anticlimactic.
Well, the end is the payoff for all the work that you did early on, and it's the getting to see the cities and stuff that you paid out.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're not in the running on the last earn, it pretty much ends for you.
Yeah. Don't you have to be able to power your cities at the end of the game in order to score them?
Yeah.
So I feel like I got to the end of the game and had like 3 more cities than anyone else, but I could only power 70% of them.
Yeah, so it has one of those things where there's a timer based on how well you're doing that ends, that says, okay, the game's going to end this round. And that's how many cities you can power, or how many are on your grid.
Yeah, how many places you've expanded to.
But the winner is who can power the most cities. And if you can't afford all the resources for that, or you don't have efficient enough power plants, you may trigger the end of the game, but not actually win it.
And that's one of the places where that market is just really cool. And, yeah. And I agree with you there. If you stuck with cool for the whole game, there's a lot of cool, but more people are bidding for that. And it might get down to the end where it's super expensive.
You could get into
and then you find yourself in that position of, oh crap, I can't power all my cities.
Yeah, you can get into a situation on the last turn where you don't have enough resources because the entire market has been bought out. And you can't power all your power plants to score, you know, all your cities.
Another thing I'll point out is that it has a couple of expansions that just give you new maps. And they tweak the rules a hair. And we got the Korea-China one.
Yeah, we played the Korean map. And that was a lot of fun because it had separate markets for North and South Korea.
And they functioned really differently.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the China one has this kind of like almost socialist system for power plants, if I remember right.
Okay.
We haven't played it yet, but I really want to play it.
Mm-hmm.
And I like games that do that. The Ticket to Ride series does that. And this one does as well, where it'll just give you new maps and they're cheap because it's just the map, but it gives a little sheet with a couple extra rules that spice up the game a bit.
Yeah, no, it's a good game. A lot of fun, for sure.
The last turn is math heavy for sure, but don't let that dissuade you from the game. I'm definitely not a math person. Hey, I'm a lawyer. We hate math. But this game is a blast. You can build up whatever power plants you want, and oftentimes you're in the running. Like, maybe I don't win all the time, but I'm definitely in second place a lot. And it's a lot of fun to see how many power plants you can build and power compared to everyone else who is calculating carefully. It's just a lot of fun.
Amber likes beating us when we're calculating, and she just goes by gut.
Absolutely.
A word of agreement, Amber. I had a friend visit Boston, Nate, you guys know, actually told me that he had played Power Grid. He brought it up with his family, and they're not heavy board gamers. So I was kind of surprised, but he said they loved it. So
yeah, it's not, I think, too difficult.
It does work on many levels.
Yeah, thematically it seems really intimidating, and the last turn is really math heavy, but really it's very accessible to the average person who enjoys board games.
And when we say math heavy, it's not like complex equations. It's like, right, you're gonna have to count things up to like 200,
and really it's
like
just
addition up to triple digits. That's what we're talking
you're
about.
You're just allocating your dollars to buy the different things you need for that last turn.
Yeah. I've heard a lot of people say this is like the alternative to Monopoly. Like, if someone's like, oh, I really like Monopoly, but I want to play these newfangled board games, what should I get? And people have recommended Power Grid. I don't know if that's a good recommendation, but it kind of has. It has auctions similarly.
I can see that. Yeah.
It's economic based. So kind of.
I really agree with that, actually.
It might actually be the next step after the Ticket to Ride games, because it has the same kind of route building.
Yeah.
Just adds more complexity. Moving on to maybe the lightest game on my entire list. Does anyone want to take a stab?
Love Letter?
No.
Codenames?
Oh, that was a good guess.
No.
I don't know. Wits and Wagers?
Nope. I've never actually played Wits and Wagers. This game is Reiner Knizia's Lost Cities.
Oh, it's fantastic. Okay.
Yeah.
This is my favorite, like, quick two-player card game. It's amazing.
Can I just say it's great for couples? All of the couples I've introduced it to have had a blast, and I love beating Mark at this game.
I will also say my parents are not board gamers at all, but my mom likes to play games, and she asked me for like a good two-player game, and I got this for her for Christmas, and She played it multiple times daily with my father for like 2 months straight, and to the point that he just was my father doesn't like board games as much as my mother does. So she had to give it to some friends for a couple weeks to let them try it out and to give him a break. But it's really a fantastic game. Very, very light, but very, very engaging at the same time.
Yeah, basically what it is it's almost a deck of cards, basically. You have cards counting up from 2 to 10 in 5 different suits, I believe. And then these special agreement cards, I think they're called. And what you're doing is just trying to play cards in ascending order within each suit. So if you get a 2 of a certain color, you can play that in front of you. And then next time, if you get a 3 or a 4, you can maybe play that on top of there. You have to play them in ascending order. And your turn consists of playing a card and then drawing a card. You can play it in front of you for points, or you can discard it into a middle area that your opponent can draw from if they wish. And you just keep doing that until you run out of the deck. But it creates these really tight, tough risk mitigation decisions where you're trying to save these higher numbered cards for later in the game. You don't want to discard them, but you don't want to play them now because you'll skip a bunch of numbers and won't make a nice big ascending pile of that suit. You don't want to skip from like 2 to 9, but you have to play something from your hand. So you have to really balance and make tough decisions of what you're going to get rid of and what you're going to play. And maybe you sacrifice points in one suit in order to try to do really well in another suit. And then you have these agreement cards that you can play first before any numbers that doubles or triples or quadruples the point value, positive or negative, of that color, which is really fun. It's fun when you can get all 3 of them and just go for one color really hard, and then your opponent just hoards all of that color. And I've seen people get angry over this game, like get in an argument.
Hey, Mark's got negative points.
I will say the agreements are my favorite part of the game because they can go so well and they can go so wrong.
What are the agreements thematically?
Well, the idea is that you're going on expeditions, so I think it's like you're getting more funding for your expedition, I think.
Okay. So if you mess up, you messed up, and your backers are mad at you.
Exactly, yeah, I think that's what it is. I will specify that we're talking about Lost Cities, the card game. There is a Lost Cities, the board game that I haven't played, but what I've heard is that it's a worse and more expensive version of the card game. So if you're going to get this, get the card game, and it should be like $12 or something.
It's very cheap.
What's the playtime?
30 minutes, maybe? 20 minutes?
You're supposed to play like 3 games. In that case, it'd be like 20 to 30 minutes. A single game can be done in like 5 to 10 minutes easy.
Yeah, I feel like we've played this in lines, you know, waiting.
Oh, yeah, it's really quick.
Yeah.
All right, moving on to number 25, a game we just played yesterday, actually. And that is the second game from Stonemaier on this list, and it is Viticulture.
Oh, Mark, this should be higher.
I know, you love this game. I really adore this game. Like Scythe, it has brilliant graphic design, brilliant art, looks beautiful in every way, and just a fantastic worker placement Euro game. It's, like I said, a worker placement game about making wine in Italy and owning a winery. You have your fields, you have to plant vineyards, you have to harvest those fields, you have to then convert those grapes into wine, and then you have to get wine orders and sell them. And that's kind of the basic cycle of winemaking in this game, but around it are a bunch of other really cool mechanisms. There are buildings you can build to give you different bonuses, you can give tours to get money. You have all these action cards which provide a lot of bonuses, and it's just such a pleasant... It's just happy, I guess. It's a pleasant worker placement game that I love. Every time I play it, I love it.
So for Viticulture, I am a little bit surprised that it's this high, actually. It's a very beautiful, pleasant game, but I like Carcassonne more for the same reasons, but it's just more elegant than Viticulture.
Yeah, Carcassonne's certainly more elegant, but I think Viticulture is the better game. I think it's more interesting.
Yeah, the only things I would say the only thing they have in common is how pleasant they are.
Yeah, they're both very pastoral.
Carcassonne is kind of a unique experience.
Sure. But I think it has interesting decisions throughout. It's not a mean Euro worker placement game. There's not a whole lot of blocking.
There's that super user.
Yeah, the Grande. Or Fatty, as we sometimes call him.
Maybe I would rank this game lower because it's not as mean or not as competitive, you might say. I don't know. It's pleasant. It's nice. It doesn't stand out to me.
It also has an amazing expansion, Tuscany, that yes. just blows the game wide open and makes a completely different experience. I love playing both the base game and with the Tuscany stuff. I think they're both excellent games for very different reasons. But overall, it's just a delight every time.
I didn't like this game as much as I know that some of you did back when we just had the base one. And then we got Tuscany, and I love it. I love Tuscany. I'm not sure why. It gives you the big difference that I can see is that it gives you the four seasons rather than dividing the worker placement into two sections. It divides it into four. And then it just has more types of cards and things like that.
Yeah, the base game is a tighter, quicker experience. And I think it's more streamlined, but it falls prey to some turn order issues. Getting like first in the very last turn of the game can be way more significant. And the action cards can either help you or hurt you more significantly in the base game. Tuscany, there's so much more openness and more options that the action cards aren't as significant to the overall scope of the game, and it fixes the turn order thing. But to me, it almost feels a little bit bloated. They're just like throwing stuff at the game. And so sometimes I think I would prefer the more streamlined experience of the original.
So let me ask you this. Do you feel like there is a significant luck element in the cards that you draw from the different piles? So there's a pile of grapes. The green pile is mm-hmm. grapes, and you need to have certain types of grapes to efficiently make sure. Red and white lines. Then you have to get order cards mm-hmm. That will ask for a particular kind of wine. So those are the two that have always struck me as a little too random. What do you think of that?
I think that the visitor cards are actually the most significant thing in the base game. In Tuscany, there are so many ways to either alternatively sell wine or draw more cards when you need to, or
even get grapes.
Or get grapes. Like, there's so many more ways to get cards that it diminishes that luck aspect a lot, I think.
That might be why I like Tuscany better.
Yeah, and it might be the better game, but it does feel a little bit bloated to me.
It's certainly just more of everything. There's more actions, there's more seasons, there's more types of workers, there's more different areas you're competing on.
There's a little mini area control mini game that they threw in there.
One really interesting thing about Viticulture that I think I've seen more here than anywhere else is how it differs in player count. So a three-player game feels really easy and breezy, and there's plenty of spaces to take, but a four-player game is really tight because you're competing for the same number of action spaces. So basically, a two-player game, you only have one action space for each category of thing. And then a three- and four-player game, you have two spots for each of those actions. And a five or six, you have three spots. So that changing the player count by one really changes how the game feels and how competitive it can be to get the certain actions.
Yeah, which I think is actually a positive for the game because it changes it up a bit.
Oh, yeah, it's just unique. I haven't seen that pronounced difference in other games.
Absolutely.
Definitely the best game to play with a glass of wine.
I don't know. We just got Vinos, which won't be on this list because I made the list before we got it. But Vinos was very... You didn't play with us, right?
No, I looked at it. It looks beautiful.
It's also about making wine, and it was very good, but like three times as heavy as Viticulture.
Yeah, it's very heavy.
Anyway, moving on to number 24, the first of three GMT games on this section of the list. That is Mark Herman's Churchill, which is a three-player game, specifically three players, and it drives Orion crazy because it's like incredibly passive-aggressive.
Yeah, it's a good game, and when you step back and when you look at it objectively, you can clearly see it's a very good, elegant, well-designed, interesting game. But when you're playing it, it is so frustrating because it's so difficult to do what you want to do. Half the game is this three-way debate on these different issues. But because it's a three-player dynamic, you can't just win a single thing you want. because there's two other people who could pull it away from you. So you have to figure out how to play the table and, you know, spend your points on the issues that other people don't care about, or know when to debate an issue and when to let someone else have it for the sake of, you know, not spending a card on it. Amber loves it.
The three-player dynamic in this game is just fantastic. I've been all three factions. I've been Roosevelt / Truman for the United States, Stalin for the USSR, and Churchill for the UK. And each one of them, the choices are just agonizing. And it's so frustrating, and I totally agree with Orion. But at the same time, it's so satisfying when you get what you want. And figuring out how to play the other two players against each other is just, it's simultaneously the worst and the best. And I have to say, this game is incredibly enjoyable just because of the tension that it creates around the table.
Yeah, so the premise of the game is it's set during World War II. One person's the US, one person's the Soviets, one person's the UK. And it's a semi-co-op game in kind of a really pure sense, in that you all have collective goals, but also individual goals at the same time. So the collective goal is to actually win World War II, which might not happen. And actually, I think last time we played, or maybe two times ago, did not happen.
To Mark's benefit.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you're trying to also give your country a great post-World War II political setup, where you're trying to gain influence and political influence over these non-actor countries, and be the one who actually hits Berlin first, or actually gets to Tokyo first, things like that. So when I say it's passive aggressive, it's really passive. It's like aggressively passive aggressive. Because as Orion said, you have these debates where it's like a three-way debate, and you're literally moving tokens over different issues regarding World War II between the three legs of this debate. Which means if two players team up, they can really screw over the third person. But generally, you want to just slightly help and slightly screw over everyone. And then the rest of it's played out on the Berlin front and the Tokyo front, where you're trying to advance troops and win battles to actually get to Berlin or Tokyo.
80% of the game is these debates. And then out of the debates, you each have a certain amount of resources and troops to allocate to these different theaters and the different fronts within those theaters. And then you just roll dice based on how many troops you put there to see if you advance your front.
Yeah, one thing I will say is that it's not a particularly, I wouldn't say it's an elegant game, because there's so many, the incentives are so tightly constructed. Like, for example, on the Eastern Front, the USSR has no chance on advancing to Germany until Normandy happens. So the USSR is strongly incentivized on a point level to
help vote for D-Day.
To go for D-Day as fast as possible with the US, but the UK, based on their track in Italy, wants to go far enough in Italy before D-Day happens so they can get more prestige. And so there's this massive scoring table that has like 20 subpoints,
and
that
this
lists all the incentives for everyone. Basically, it's kind of convoluted, but it ends up working out in execution very well. It's just not elegant.
This is my biggest problem with the game. There's frustrating parts, but this is my biggest issue with the game, is that the point scoring is so convoluted. And every time we've played, we've always had the score wrong. And so you can't tell if you're actually winning or not. And I've had multiple games where I thought I was winning by 10 points and was maneuvering based on that in going into the last two or three turns. But I was actually losing by 15, and I should have been making completely different plays based on that and focusing my efforts against one person versus the other. And some of that is we just need a better system of keeping track of the points.
I think there's a website that automates it for you now.
Okay.
So I'm going to try to find that next time we play.
But it's really, the scoring is really convoluted and not intuitive.
Is there always a winner? Can you just lose World War II and then everyone loses?
Yes. But there is always a winner.
No, there's always a winner.
There's always a winner. You can lose World War II, but still be the winner among the big three.
Be going in the best political position.
Right.
Okay.
Although I believe it's an official alternate rule that you can count a World War II loss as a loss for everybody.
Come on, it's
but
a
there's
loss.
there's a really weird end game scoring thing where you want to win, but not by a large margin, because it adds this random element where the people behind get extra points.
Well, no, if you win by too much, essentially the other two form a coalition against you and overpower you in the post-war political scene, yeah, where the second place person then wins the game.
That's interesting. That's really interesting.
Yeah. So it forces you to keep the points really tight. And so, like I said, it provides very strict incentives in that sense, but it does through convoluted means. But I love the game. I love the dynamics. I love three-player games in general, and this one is fantastic. All right, moving on to another GMT game, the Behemoth Fire in the Lake, also by Mark Herman and Volker Runke. This is the most complicated, I found out after we purchased it, the most complicated of the famed coin games from GMT, and it was a beast to learn.
Wasn't this like our first foray into war games in general?
Yeah, it was probably the wrong move. I probably should have picked one of the simpler coin games first. This one took a while, but I think it's very rewarding. Even though after a few plays, I still really have no idea what a good strategy is. So the coin games are...
You're saying you have no idea how to win a war in Vietnam.
Correct. Okay. The coin games are counterinsurgency, that's what it stands for, base games, based on historical conflicts. They have one about the Cuban Revolution, they have one about Chile, I believe. This one is about the war in Vietnam. It's a four-player asymmetric game, like very asymmetric, and kind of has the same sort of things in Churchill with like semi-cooperation. Basically, you have the North Vietnam, one player is the North Vietnamese, one player is the Viet Cong, another player is South Vietnam, and the fourth player is the United States. So South Vietnam and the United States are somewhat allied.
They're nominal allies.
They're somewhat allied. Similarly, North Vietnam and the Viet Cong are somewhat allied.
They don't hate each other, basically.
Well, the interesting part of this game is that there are two dynamics that you're competing on. One is control of regions, where you have the most troops there, and the other is public support in those regions. So the U.S. and the Viet Cong are competing on the support axis, where the North and South Vietnamese are competing on the control axis.
Yeah, which is just a fascinating dynamic, and I love that part of the game. But when I say asymmetrical, like, each of the two sides have the same four actions with minor details missing, but then each of the players has three or four completely unique actions.
Special actions.
Special actions that they have to learn. So not only are you learning the game, you have to learn like your role in the game. And they vary completely dramatically, but it creates a really cool simulation where the U.S. is just monstrously powerful on a military front, but part of their points is determined by how many troops they have sent back to the United States because the war isn't popular. And then the Viet Cong has a whole bunch of actions dealing with terrorist attacks, which are unique to them.
It's worth playing multiple times, that's for sure, just to get a handle on it. And it's interesting each time.
Yeah, don't get turned off by the first play. It is very heavy, at least for us, and takes some effort to learn. But it's a lot of fun. I really love it.
One other thing I think is really interesting in this game is that South Vietnam and the United States have to share their resource pool.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that.
And that creates an amazingly intricate dynamic between them, because I would say that they are more strongly lumped together than the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese army.
Yeah, speaking of aggressively passive aggressive.
Yeah. Yeah, Amber and I are never, ever, ever again being the United States and South Korea.
You don't ever want to be the United States South in the Vietnam War. What? Just no.
Because last time that happened, it was bad.
So with GMT games in general, we've done two, and you say there's another coming. Do they feel balanced? Have you played these two games enough times to know if they're balanced, being so asymmetric?
I think I'd have to play dozens of times to know that, because they're so complicated, and they're not as easy to be like, okay, this is a good strategy, as many Euro games.
Yeah.
they're certainly imbalanced on different axes, right? So Viet Cong has like no military presence in Fire in the Lake, but they have, that's not really related to their goals. And Churchill himself is the best at debating, but is in kind of the toughest military predicament and doesn't get points based off of the development of the atomic bomb, which the USSR and US can get points based off of. So they're very asymmetric in that way, and I don't know if they're balanced, but I don't really care because they're much more about the simulation and the experience of playing out these historical events.
Yeah, and that's cool.
That it doesn't really matter to me.
Right, you wouldn't compare it to some super tightly balanced Euro game where there's, you know, three or four strategies, and depending on the player and the actions and blah, 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 one can win, but it's a matter of like 3 points or difference.
Do you get the cool sense of alternate history that we sometimes talk about?
With Churchill a bit more, just because I know World War II better than Vietnam. I don't really know anything about the details of Vietnam. I never read like a book on Vietnam. So for those who are interested in that conflict and have read the history of it, I'm sure it's a lot richer and more interesting.
The very little that I've read, for sure, the game brought out a whole range of alternate histories, which was very interesting.
And similar to the rest of the coin games and some other GMT war games, it's driven by these deck of cards where each action or each round is you flip over a new card and then you can take actions, and one of the actions is to play out the event on that card, and then the other action is to do one of your general abilities.
Yeah, and it's a fantastic system. I would recommend any of the coin games, even though I've only played two of them, because I'm sure they're all great. Moving on to number 22, stepping aside from the GMT games, going on to a game I just inexplicably adore, even though every like cynical part of my brain says not to, and that's Takedo, a beautiful, beautiful game from Anthony Bauza about taking a walk in Japan.
But you're trying to take the best walk.
Yes, you're trying to take the best, most enriching walk in Japan. It's stupidly simple. There's a path with different spots you can stop on. Whoever's furthest behind in that path gets to choose a spot that's open. And you keep doing that until the end. And it has a little bit of set collection. It has a lot of different types of set collection, actually. And you just get points here and there, and you buy some souvenirs, and you eat some meals at the end, and then it ends, and you just had an amazing time. Besides it looking amazing and having great art and just being pleasant in general, I think I love this game because this is the only way I can justify it being this high on the list. It's a game where you can always go to like the next open spot, which is probably a decent move, and the entire game's just trying to figure out if the two in front of that are better. So you have like these very limited choices that can sometimes be difficult, but it just gives you very easily presented choices that just seem, it creates this whole experience of seeming just very relaxing and pleasant. And I think it's super fun.
Yeah, if you have family members or friends who hate board games because they're non-confrontational or hate fighting, this is the game for them. Everyone has a great time during it. And it's really nice. Everyone is very nice to each other. There's good options. I would say it's good for anyone to play.
Yeah, another super light game, great for families. Except for, I will say, the two-player variant, is incredibly confrontational and incredibly mean.
So I feel like I was turned off from this game simply because of how much you and Wes inexplicably adored it right from the very onset. And to me, maybe it's my action paralysis. Sorry.
Analysis paralysis?
My analysis paralysis. Or just the annoyance, and the fact that it is very tactical and not strategic, because you're usually only weighing the options so far in front of you. And I feel like this game is extremely passive aggressive. I'm always trying to, like, I always have to figure out what everyone else is doing and then figure out who it's most beneficial to screw over.
But Matt, you're not playing it right.
I know.
You're not playing it right at all.
I'm not just going for a lovely walk.
You're walking around the trail, like looking over your shoulder.
Yeah.
Jumping at birds fly out of the trees.
Apparently, I have this black heart that...
You want to deprive other people of having nice walks so that you can have the best walk.
But you always seem to end up at the hot springs with the monkeys, and I don't understand it.
Yeah, you always get the monkeys. In Tokaido, you can go to hot springs, and just like in real life, and that's not a joke, sometimes monkeys are there. Look it up.
But the ones with monkeys are worth more points.
Obviously, because a monkey is always worth more points.
Yeah, I'll say, this game's never really done as much for me as it sounds like it does for you. It's an enjoyable game. It's a game where you don't really have to think too hard, and you don't really care if you lose. It is, I don't, Matt. But
yeah, yeah. Well, again, this is another problem. For some reason, I really care about winning when I play this game.
But that's the thing. I care about winning too, but I also feel like take a nice walk.
This game feels like it should be as pleasant as Carcassonne or Viticulture. And I always have the opposite experience. I will say this, though. I feel bad about it. I feel like the problem may be with me and not the game.
I think we should get Amber over here, not my wife, but your girlfriend, Amber, to play with you, and then maybe that will soften this black heart of yours.
Or maybe it will just be a terrible experience for her.
That's true, but it's worth it for science. All right. Moving down to the final entry on the list, the other coin game that we have played, that is Falling Sky from Volker Runge, and I think his son, Andrew Runge, which is the same system as Fire in the Lake, but it's quite a bit simpler. And this one, instead of being set in Vietnam, is about Caesar's invasion of Gaul. So you have one player as Caesar and the other three players as various Gaelic or Belgic tribes. And then there's Germans sitting there that do their own thing. But it's the same exact coin system. Again, this one's a lot simpler. There aren't as many axes to cover, and the actions seem a lot simpler. And I found it more enjoyable. Fire in the Lake may have more depth, but at least kind of on a first impression, I think I enjoyed this one a bit better.
Falling Sky was certainly more intuitive to it for us, and that may be because we already played Fire in the Lake and had a grasp on the coin system. But I love this game off the top just because of the theme, because I love that part of history and the Roman Empire and the wars in that couple centuries. And I think I would love it even if the gameplay was mediocre, but the gameplay is quite good and compelling, and it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, this game is fantastic for all the reasons Falling Sky was, but each of the goals of the four factions was slightly easier to grasp. And so I think it was easier for each of us to have a goal in mind and try to reach that goal in a more streamlined fashion. And of course, it helps that I won.
You pulled off a great win.
I have only played this game once, but I enjoyed it thoroughly. And since it's the same coins get system as Fire in the Lake, I feel like I've played it more times.
Yeah, the thing with this game is that the different factions' goals, it's much easier to see how to progress toward your goal. Whereas with Fire in the Lake, it's much more obtuse and harder to get there.
Absolutely. Like, the connection, like, I've had to research, like, cheat sheets that actually explain the association between the various actions in Fire in the Lake and what the actual goal you're trying to accomplish is. In Falling Sky, it's a lot more direct. Falling Sky is almost 1-3, although, as in all coin games, everyone has their own individual win conditions. But in some sense, all the Gallic tribes are trying to fight off Caesar.
It's more of a free-for-all than Fire in the Lake is.
Yeah.
But there are nominal alliances between the green and yellow player and the blue and player and the red Romans.
And I also feel like your actions have more permanence in Falling Sky. In Fire in the Lake, they have this tsunami or monsoon season thing that really just changes the state of the board dramatically, periodically in the game. Falling Sky's version of that, which is winter, didn't seem to change as much on the board.
Yeah, that's true.
So, of the two coin games, I highly recommend this system. For a first one, I'd say Falling Sky is definitely better than Fire in the Lake. I've heard that the first two, the Cuban one and the Chilean one, are also similarly easy if you're trying to get an introduction to this system. Don't start out with Fire in the Lake like we did. Because even though it's an amazing game, it was a bear to get through.
But definitely play Fire in the Lake after you've played one of the other ones.
Oh, certainly. And I think that's it for our list today. That is numbers 30 through 21. Tune in 2 weeks where we go over numbers 20 through 11 and near the top 10. I had everyone here write out their guesses, for what they think my top 10 is before we recorded this. And we will see. I think one was already crossed off of Ben's list.
and Matt's.
Oh, man, we're already knocking games off the list. So check in again with us in 2 weeks for the next installment. Next week, we'll have a regular podcast, as we do every other week. This one's running on the off weeks. Please check out the website at thethoughtfulgamer.com. And please feel free to rate and review us, particularly on iTunes, so I can see what people are rating us as, because iTunes has some sort of rating threshold. And it helps us get visibility. And feel free to follow me on Twitter and on Facebook. And again, that the website is thethoughtfulgamer.com. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye.
Thanks for listening.